After 6 months at language school in northern Ethiopia, we finally moved south to our first mission station. Father, whose career as a doctor had been on hold, was posted to a hospital near the town of Sodu in Wileta District. There, we occupied a real house instead of a temporary apartment. The suitcases could stop masquerading as dressers. And though my older brother was still away at boarding school in Addis Ababa, I had my younger brother, Nat, to distract me. Plus, I now had a yard to gallop in, with grass kept short by a tethered donkey. Out back, a huge avocado tree spread over the lawn, and this tree was a wonderful leafy world unto itself. Though barely 5, I found that I was able to clamber up inside the green dome of leaves. Once there, where heavy limbs reached out parallel to the ground, I prowled in secret like my pet chameleon, holding thinner branches as handrails. From hidden perches, I monitored the whole mission compound seen into the countryside all around. The Wileta region was lush compared to the cold, grassy plateau at Deber Berhan. Farm plots covered the terrain, stitched together in green and yellow squares and rectangles and trapezoids, blanketing the valleys and even the gentle sloping mountains. Banana trees flourished behind each thatched house with leaves big as elephant ears. Papaya trees shot skyward too, looking like telephone poles that had sprouted green footballs. A red dirt road split the 15 acres owned by the mission. To the south, where the road entered the compound, 4 whitewashed classrooms boxed in an open field that served as a parade ground and soccer pitch for the mission's elementary school. I could see tin flashing through a row of trees and hear Ethiopian children calling out to each other at recess. Across from these classrooms, a series of long, narrow buildings stretched out in parallel rows, linked by roofed walkways. This was the clinic and patient wards. Made of chica, an Ethiopian adobe of mud and straw and dung, these walls were whitewashed like all walls on the compound, and the roofs were made of tin so they shimmered with silver light at midday. Through the leaves of the avocado tree I could spy into open windows where the wooden shutters had been thrown open and patients lay on their iron beds, motionless, black silhouettes waiting to feel better. About 15 missionaries worked at Sodu, and their houses were spread out along the remaining dirt drive. Across from us was the Anderson squat blocky house with a spray of banana trees covering one corner. Then came the Schmitz and the Bergens, and the road petered out 50 yards up the slope, where old Selma lived next to her beloved bookshop full of ink-scented gospel tracts and Amharic New Testaments. I clambered around in the dark foliage of our avocado tree every day, spying on this new world and picking the wrinkled fruit and squeezing it to feel if it was ripe. Mom made me avocado sandwiches on request, spreading the slick green pulp like butter or adding sliced egg and salt. Then I climbed right back into the tree with half a sandwich clamped in my mouth to hide up there under the green umbrella, happily watching the mouse birds as they came and went, pirouetting on their thin tail feathers. I even dreamed at night that I could scramble out on the giant limbs until they bent down and delivered me to lower branches so that I'd slip slide clear to the ground. Like my chameleon, which I kept in a box of avocado leaves, I felt safest in this dark green refuge. The only Ethiopian I encountered daily was Marta, the houseworker, with her hair bound up in a blue turban firm as a soccer ball, and her face turned gentle by a smile. As she stoked the wood stove and wrung out the wet sheets, she hummed hypnotic tunes. She murmured the same word over and over, Jesus. I felt at ease around Marta, but take me elsewhere, and I became as cautious as my chameleon. If Mom brought me along to fetch Dad from the hospital, I turned my face into her skirts and froze as soon as we entered the waiting room. Dozens of Ethiopian patients were there, perched on wooden benches or lying on the cement floor. These six strangers with veined wood smoke eyes and callous skin always wanted to finger my crew cut and cup my arms as if weighing the soft white flesh. They spat on Nat's corn silk hair to show their appreciation. Batam Truno, they whispered in awe, as if looking at a remarkable painting or a large diamond. I found them weird and frightening, so I hid and refused to answer questions. As far as I was concerned, they didn't exist. The avocado tree, the chameleon, the sky, these were my only companions, aside from Marta, Nat, and my parents. As a result, what I learned about Ethiopian culture came to me slowly. One morning, as Mother planned the Bible lesson she would teach to a women's group, cutting out a cardboard figure of little Zacchaeus the tax collector, high in his lookout tree, searching for Jesus, she burst out uncharacteristically, "If they wanted us to work with the Waleda people, then why didn't they teach us Waleda?" It had never occurred to me that in Ethiopia there might be more languages than the one Mom and Dad had wrestled with at Deborah Berhan. Stunned, I asked, "Mama, don't they speak Amharic?" She sighed, "Only a few, and it's not the women." Because of this language gap, Mom often had trouble being understood by Marta. She would bite her lips in exasperation as she tried to pantomime yet another foreign task, such as how to mix the ingredients for an angel food cake, beating only the egg whites and beating them until they were stiff enough to stand, then adding sifted flour and confectioner's sugar, bit by bit. She became so desperate about managing Marta that she resorted to a pictograph drawn in colored pencil. First, she rendered our kitchen clock with an oversized hand pointing to 9. Then she penned in the black iron stove with red flames blazing from its open door, implying that Marta should refuel it at this time. She drew clock hands pointing to 10 and paired this with a blue checkered dress over a basin of sudsy water, time for laundry. Then she drew pots and pans on the stove and a clock with both hands pointing to noon, lunch. When Dad came home from the hospital, he too seemed befuddled sometimes. "I had a man jump out the window today," he announced. "Charles," Mom gasped. "He didn't. Head first. When I told him I needed to take his blood, he dove." Curious as always, I broke in. "But Daddy, why would you take his blood?" "To see what was wrong with him." "Then why did he run away?" Dad grinned. "Now that's the million-dollar question. I guess he thought I was going to steal his soul." "That's crazy," I replied. Mom chastised me. "Timmy, don't say crazy." "Mom's right," Dad added. "He probably didn't know anything about microbes. Some people in Sodu think that our spirits live in our blood, so maybe he thought I would take his spirit." My picture of Ethiopia was my parents' picture, except for rare, weird glimpses stolen from the safety of my crow's nest high in the avocado tree. Sometimes, when I had found the right roost, I would spy on incoming patients. A group of farmers came along, walking two abreast with their calloused toes splayed as they strained under a stretcher of eucalyptus poles and strapped cloth. The woman they carried, pregnant and weary to death, lay buried under white cotton shawls. Only her hands showed, clamping the poles of the litter in a claw-like grip, and all I could hear, beside the muffled footfalls in the dust, was her labored breathing, which came out in sudden moaning bursts, like air forced from a bellows. They passed, then along came a blind man, led by a little girl who held on to the opposite end of his staff, guiding him down the road. They went very slowly, because his legs were swollen up thick as an elephant's legs and covered with bloody bandages. Then came a boy a bit older than me, maybe even the age of my brother Jonathan, who swung himself along on a single T-shaped crutch. The leg next to the crutch ended at the knee in a brown stump. When he stopped and looked up, he spotted me. He just stood there and gawked, mouth open in a happy gap. I had seen this boy lurching by our house before, and I imagined he attended the mission's elementary school, where Mom taught English classes. I had overheard Dad muttering once when he noticed the boy, All they had to do was to bring him to us. He meant the words for Mom, who was standing next to him carving a loaf of bread, but I blurted out, "Who didn't bring him?" So Dad explained. The boy had fallen out of a tree and broken his leg, but the healer in his village insisted no one should go to the foreign doctors. He splinted the leg himself, tying the splint so tightly the blood couldn't flow. The boy's leg didn't improve. On the contrary, it began to smell like dead fish. He had gangrene, Dad said. And once you get gangrene, there's nothing anyone can do except cut away the ruined part.
You cut off his leg?
We had to. But Timmy, Mom interrupted, and she adopted her Sunday school voice, do you see how he smiles? He learned about Jesus while he was here. That's why he comes back so much. Now, as I stared down from the avocado tree, the crippled boy waved. I put my finger over my lips. He put his own finger over his lips. I pointed down the road, meaning for him to go on. He gestured back the same way, pointing, as if I should walk away from my perch into midair. Then I laughed, unable to help myself, and he laughed too. He pivoted on his crutch and swung away, still smiling that enigmatic smile, so unexpected from a boy with only one leg. The Wolaita Christians, all of them, had this something that the boy had, something that I didn't have, and that not even Mom and Dad had, despite all their spiritual yearning. They seemed to carry secret wells inside themselves that bubbled over in the very throes of pain. When evening descended, they would comfort each other by breaking into spontaneous song, chanting strange antiphonal tunes that quavered in minor keys, tender to my unaccustomed ears. Jesus was poor, the lead singer called out in a tremulous voice, letting the words lift high into the dim, tin-covered rafters of the hospital ward. Jesus was poor, all the other patients chanted back. We are poor too, she sang, and they echoed. We are poor too, but God took care of Jesus. Yes, God took care of Jesus. And God will take care of us. Sometimes the lead singer even made up new verses. Jesus was lonely, we are lonely too. Or Jesus was sick, we are sick too. On and on she went, and the other patients faithfully followed, lying back in their metal cots full of aches and pains, but chanting out this strange, sweet trust. Their voices drifted out the painless windows of the mud-walled hospital and across the red dirt road, hanging in the lowering dark, then wafting through our screen door on the evening breeze. The sound drifted through the dimming rooms of our house, then out the back door into the dusky yard and the shadowed avocado. I felt something deeply holy about such words and music, even though I understood so little. At this hour, Dad would also go out and start the generator in the little shed behind our house. He yanked at the cord of the antique machine until slowly, patiently, it pumped to life, puttering like the submerged motor on a trawler. This faithful engine, after it had steadied itself on its oil-stained cement pad, settled into a deep thumping rhythm, pucka, 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 and I always thrilled at the sound. With it came electricity, the invisible stuff that snaked its way into the house in wires and woke up all the light bulbs. With it came light itself. What a wonderful, consistent sound, the pumping of that sturdy old generator. It was time itself, moving predictably, not rushed or spastic. It meant a range of calm things. It meant the coming of the night. It meant the North Star already bright on the horizon. It meant the moon. Sometimes Mother would heat the cast iron kettle on the wood stove and scrub me down in the kitchen. She plopped me into a galvanized wash basin next to my one-year-old brother, Nat. If the water went cold, she pulled us out like laundry that needed to be rinsed. Then she added scalding water from the kettle, stirred it a bit, and lifted us back in to be deliciously warmed. I could hear the distant tremolo of the singing patients over the steady pumping of the generator, and I sang my own unconscious song. Jesus was a child too, just like me, but God took care of Jesus, and God will take care of me. I fooled around, tickling Nat, because I knew that if we could prolong the whole wet and slippery process until 9 o'clock, the generator would be turned off to save fuel. Then the two of us boys might get dried off in the warm yellow light of a candle, which was magical in its own way. Maybe we could even escape Mom's grip to race through the flickering house chasing our giant shadows. If we could just keep her in a good mood, then we might get one last minute of abandonment, delirious with our own clean skin and wet hair. Eventually, though, we were captured. We went to our beds and said our prayers, careful to include Brother Jonathan at Bingham Academy and Sisoni Doke, the Indonesian orphan we sponsored through World Vision. I thought of the crippled boy, too, whose name I did not know. Lord, take care of the boy with one leg and everybody else in the whole world. In Jesus' name, amen. Then I did what all children must do. I went to sleep and grew older.